G'day everyone and welcome to Life in the Peloton. I'm on the eve of the Vuelta a España and I thought I'd sit down with Lionel to introduce the next episode. Welcome Lionel.
Hi there Mitch. It's just gone mid-October and you're getting ready for a three-week Grand Tour. It must feel really quite strange. The days are getting shorter, the temperature's dipping a bit. What's it like there in Spain where you are?
I tell you what, it felt like today the break of spring. It was a very, very weird feeling because it was like a bit cool in the air. The sun was breaking through and I thought, this feels like a day just after, you know, Paris-Roubaix and I'm just starting to get myself ready for the next block. And I was like, hang on, it's the end of the year and I'm about to step into the Vuelta a España. It doesn't feel like I'm on the eve of a Grand Tour, let alone the Vuelta. So it is a very surreal feeling, but on the other side of things, I'm very much looking forward to doing a big race and making 2020 all worthwhile with, you know, a big race at the end of the year.
Well, it is the day after the Tour of Flanders, so I suppose you weren't that far wrong. It's very, very unusual, though.
It is very unusual, and it's very unusual watching these races and everything being out of sync, and it is just a bizarre sort of season, but, you know, whatever it was 2-3 months ago or maybe 4 months ago, I was very skeptical that we would get this far. And I'm very happy that we have got this far. I never thought we'd be able to do all this and race so late, but it's amazing what you can get yourself to do when the circumstances are changed.
So who's in this week's episode of Life in the Peloton, Mitch?
I've got an exciting episode this week. I thought it'd be very good to bring this episode up because I originally wanted to release this when the Vuelta a España was originally on, because today I'm talking to Greg Griffiths, who is a UCI International Commissaire, and he is from Australia, and I sat down with him over the summer when I was in Australia. He actually doesn't live too far away from me. He's from Melbourne. And we were talking about when I see him at the Vuelta a España, and I take note from him popping his head out of the top of the car there. And I thought, great, this is going to be a great episode to release just before the Vuelta. So here we are, a little bit delayed. We're on the eve of the Vuelta. I thought, it'd be great to hear about behind the scenes from a commissaire, what they actually have to do, how they can unpack the rules, how they make those decisions, the daily life of a comm. So it's a pretty good episode. I hope you enjoy it. Sit back and enjoy Greg Griffiths. Well, welcome, Greg. Greg Griffiths, that is, UCI International Commissaire. What I wanted to say to you first off the bat is the last time I saw you, I think was about stage 15 at the start at the Vuelta a España. I was sitting there nervously on the line. You were there in your smart white shirt, just stepped out of your red car. We just had a casual conversation on the start of the line there, and I went my merry little way up the road, and you went your merry little way back into the car. And that was that. Was that the last time we saw each other?
I think it was, Mitch. And thanks for coming along tonight and having this chat. It should be interesting for us both, I think.
What I wanted to ask was, what did you actually do from that stage at that point? Because I went up the road and I had a hell of a day following the wheels, but then you stepped into the car and what happened from that moment?
First thing, I wound the windows up. Second thing, I put the air conditioner on. Unlike yourself, I had some comfort for the day. But you know, the job as a commissaire is to make sure that the race is run fairly and within the rules and safely as well. So, you know, during the day we just concentrate on all the things that can happen in a bike race with 170 or 80 riders.
All right, well then let's take it back a few steps from there, because now everyone's hearing that international commissaire. What does that actually mean? And all sports have a referee. Commissaires are our referee. And to go back to the beginning, what is a commissaire?
Well, I guess firstly explaining that to other people, you usually have to explain that it's a French word, so it means an official or a referee, as you've mentioned. Also, it can be a judge. So a commissaire at a bike race can be someone who judges the finish line, who follows in the car to watch the race evolve. And this is on the road. There's also track commissaires and mountain bikes, so all the disciplines have their own commissaires. But it's just the officials that adjudicate on the race. So it's like a soccer referee or a, you know, Aussie rules umpire, so same type of thing.
Well, then how do you become a commissaire? And why do you want to become a commissaire? Because you were a rider, an ex-rider. I raced against you, a very good rider along your way. But then you decided to make the switch to be a commissaire.
Yeah. Well, I raced from 1971 until 2002, so it was a long time. Not internationally as you race yourself, but at a high level in Australia. I had a bad crash in 2002. I'd already done some commissaring prior to that at club and state level, and even became a national commissaire in 2001. And I could see that I was nearing the end, so had to plan for the future. A lot of my peers were becoming coaches, and I could see that that side of the sport was oversupplied, if you like. There was, you know, a million coaches, and probably in later in my years as a rider, I was starting to get a little desperate in some manoeuvres, and I probably spoke to a few commissaires along the way, and I guess I thought perhaps I could do as good a job or a better job than some of the people I dealt with, so I proceeded further. So I think 2000 I was a state commissaire, 2001 a national commissaire, in 2004 an international commissaire. So it was quite a fast progression.
And they are the levels. That was another question I wanted to ask you. They are the levels. Is that all there is, the three levels for anyone out there?
Well, for start, if you're starting off in the current regime, it's there's a club commissaire, which is something that parents often do online. It's just a course to make people familiar with the regulations, and then they can officiate a club race and help out around the club.
So if you're doing a Northern Combine road race out here in the suburbs, you can be a club commissaire.
Yep.
Is that all it is?
You can do it, be a club commissaire. So it just means, firstly, that as a commissaire, you'll have a license, so you'll have some insurance. So that's obviously important. You know, if you're racing at a road race, accidents can happen. You can be on the wrong end of the law. So it's good to have some insurance. Also, you've got the knowledge of the regulations, or at least some knowledge, so that you can assist younger riders and club riders who don't perhaps go to bigger events and have more rules to follow. So it's a starting point. So as riders starting off, start at club level, so can commissaires.
And then, so take me back to the beginning, how do you become a commissaire? How does that process go about? Is it just a simple course, and how did you go along those steps so quickly, as you said?
I guess I didn't do it. When I started, there wasn't such a thing as the club level. So I just started at state level. The next year happened to be there was a national championships at Vodafone, and they held a national commissaires course there, and I thought, well, I can do this, so I did that.
That's the track in the centre of Melbourne, Vodafone Arena.
Correct, yep. So there was about 15 of us, I guess, did the course. I think most passed. I was the top of the class. That was good.
Nice.
And then I was approaching the age of 50.
To be top of the class, do you think that was just purely because of your cycling knowledge, or just because a combination of things?
I think it had a lot to do with it, because when I did the state course in 2000, I think it was, I was also the top of the class at the state level. So even though I'd never done any commissaring, when I did the course, I was... had the top marks in the class. So obviously 30 years of being a rider, I knew a lot of, not everything, but I knew a lot of what should happen and what shouldn't happen, and when questions are asked, I knew what was right and what was wrong, even though as a rider maybe I couldn't find that line sometimes. You know, it's just came a little more naturally, I guess.
Nice. Well, you've run through the different levels of commissaring and the qualifications. Define the role of a commissaire, and let's maybe just jump to your level, because that's probably a bit more familiar with people listening out there. They're watching the Tour de France, they're watching the Vuelta, they're watching the Paris-Roubaix on TV, and they're policed or refereed by you in a lot of those races. I see you overseas as well, as well as races here in Australia. But what is the official role of the commissaire on the day?
Well, actually, it starts before the day, which is often unknown by a lot of people, and that's perhaps the one of the purposes of this podcast. You know, people can learn these things. But if I'm appointed, or any commissaire is appointed by the UCI, usually we find that out in October for road events, so for the coming season. Then we accept the appointment or not. If you accept, then you contact the race organiser, get all the details on the race. If you're the president commissaire, then you need to make sure that all the requirements are there for the race, so to do with medical, police, road.
So there's a bit of paperwork involved.
So there's a lot of work prior to the event, because you don't want to just turn up to a race in, well, I did a race in Uzbekistan last year. You don't want to turn up to a race in Uzbekistan and find out there's no police, no ambulance, because then the race doesn't happen. So you've got to make sure that all that infrastructure's there prior. Also, we would receive the entry list of all the riders. We have to check on the UCI website to make sure that those riders are currently registered with the team that they're entered with.
Wow.
Make sure that the...
Every rider, yeah.
Yeah, every rider. So, and you, as you'd be aware, there's now the UCI ID, the 11-digit code, so that needs to correspond with each rider. So we need to make sure that that's correct. Then when we get to the race, we meet with the organiser. make sure that all the things he said are in place, So you try and meet the doctor, meet the TV people.
Does all that come back on your head? For instance, you check something or you happen to look over something just quickly because of the whatever's happening on the day, and actually something happens in the race. For instance, you go, there had to be this certain amount of police and there wasn't that many, and you just missed that in the check. Is that back on your head then?
If something bad happens, then yeah, it can
comes
be.
Back on the commissaire.
Yeah, so
because you're the final.
We're the representative of the UCI, so even though we're volunteers in effect, there's often or most often not staff from the UCI at the event. So that's the role of the commissaire to ensure that the race has what it's supposed to have. Mm. The riders are professional. The teams are professional. So even though we're not professional, we need to act in a professional manner and ensure that the field of play, if you like, is, you know, safe. Fair. For you guys.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so, because how many commissaires we have on a given day? Because I often notice there's Com 1, Com 2, Com 3 in the cars. Is there more guys out there that I don't know about? Is there guys behind the scenes?
Are you sounding worried, Mitch?
I'm just thinking that's a lot of work, and I'm thinking surely that's got to be split up between a few guys.
There's generally, depending on the level of the race, there'll be either three or four commissaires in cars. So Commissaire 2 is the commissaire that travels in front of the race from the start and then will drop behind the breakaway once the breakaway establishes.
If there's no break, what do they do? Just drive in the front, have a great day.
They drive it, yeah, but they don't have a great day because he's generally looking around, waiting for the brake to come, so he ends up with a sore neck. So, you know, that's a bit of a pain. But then Com 1 is the main commissaire. He's behind the peloton in the car. Then Commissaire 3 will be halfway back in the convoy. And if it's a bigger race, there'll also be Commissaire 4. And races in Australia, such as the Melbourne to Warrnambool, we have up to Commissaire 9. So there's
all groups,
a lot
stuff.
Of commissaires, because it's a big, long race with a lot of riders. So you need to have coverage for all those groups.
What's the prestige position if you get it drawn out? You're like, you're Com 1? Is that?
Oh, Com 1, you're the boss of the race. So that's the main role. And it's also the most work.
So why so?
Well, there's all that work we mentioned prior to the race.
So that lays on Com 1's
job. Com 1 does all that. Hmm. But also after the race, then you've got to write a race report. So, you know, often if I'm doing a race in Europe, the race report takes the 12 hours that the flight is coming back to Australia, you know. So it needs to be correct. The UCI, as I've mentioned, are not at the race, so they need to have all of the information on the race. So you need to write a report, and that's sometimes I find probably the hardest part of the job is finding the time to get the report done before you go to the next race, you know, which might be the next day, for instance. So
is that all just notifying things that went wrong, or is it just giving a whole general report of?
We've got a new report form, which is very detailed, and it covers everything from safety, riders' accommodation.
Oh, really?
Meals.
You're kidding me.
Flights to and from.
How would you know about the meals and stuff? Just hearing complaints or reports?
Go around the teams and ask a couple of team managers, has there been any issues?
So going back to the comms and their positions, you got Com 1 who sits behind. He's making the final... Does he make the final call on what has to happen that day?
No, each commissaire works autonomously. So apart from the four that I've mentioned in the cars, there's generally two on motorbikes as well,
okay,
plus the judging panel. And sometimes if there's intermediate sprints or KOMs, they'll be along the race. So they can also, if the race splits up into eight groups and you've only got four commissaires and two on motorbikes, you've got a couple of groups perhaps without a commissaire. So if a judge is available before they have to go to their next point, they can be with a group for a while. So,
do they have commissaring capabilities, judges?
Yeah, but they are commissaires. Generally, in an international race, there'll be national commissaires. So if it's at the Vuelta, they'd be Spanish commissaires.
Okay.
So they're national commissaires in Spain.
Yeah, right. But
generally, they wouldn't penalise someone. They would report to the chief if there was a problem.
Right. Can you tell the difference as a rider, a judge, just looking at them compared to a commissaire? Will they wear different clothes and
at
stuff?
An international event, the UCI commissaires will be in a red... generally a red car, not always, but generally a red car, and we'll have the UCI uniform. At a national event here in Australia, likewise, the commissaires would have a national uniform on.
It's good to know, because if we're split up into echelons and I just see a judge next to me, I know I can maybe get away with a little bit here and there, and he's only going to report it back to you.
Yeah, but if he's got a phone and he videos
and
these days, any evidence is evidence, so...
That's right.
You know, don't do the wrong thing, Mitch.
I was just thinking about, you know... Maybe getting a sticky bottle or something.
Well, that's obviously one of the favourite things, and it, people, like I work in a bike shop, people come in and talk about watching the tour or whatever on TV, and they're all talking about the sticky bottles because the commentators have mentioned that, and some of them, some people think it's actually sticky. You know, it's just being held onto at 60k an hour. Yeah.
I love making the joke when I see one on the TV. I'm like, geez, there must have been a fair bit of honey on that bottle. His hand got stuck on there for ages.
Yeah.
So, well, I wasn't going to talk about that, but I do want to talk about that. There is a bit of a grey area where stuff can, like, for instance, getting bottles from the car. At what point is it all individual judgment on that? Some guy might be like, if I don't see that, if I see his hand on there for more than 1 second, he's done. Another guy might be like, 3-4 seconds, that's fine.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty much up to the individual, but also the race situation comes into account.
Sure.
If the bunch is going along at 30k an hour and then the pressure's not on and the guy's holding onto the bidon for 10 seconds, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
He's chatting to his manager, he's not gaining any advantage as long as it's not on a climb.
Sure.
But if the guy's obviously half cooked and he's about to go out the back and he gets a bottle and it's a sticky one and he comes back, then that's not fair on the guys that have
exactly.
dropped him. So there would be a penalty in that case. But if another situation, a rider comes back to get 6 bottles for his team. If he gets a sticky bottle just to maintain speed, he has to sit up, freewheel, put the bottle down his jersey.
In the Vuelta, say, 40 degrees.
Yeah. Loses 50 metres each time he does that. As a commissaire, we would accept that he's going to get a sticky bottle to get him back to the position he was, so he hasn't lost 50 metres every time he gets a bottle. Otherwise, he's out the back and his team doesn't get fed. So
that's right. It's just a bit of common sense, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. You explained before that you get your program presented to you by the UCI, where you can select how many races you want to do, and is that more or less how it goes? Do you have to do a minimum amount of race days, and how many days would you do in a typical year?
It varies from year to year. Some year, like this year's an Olympic year, and I didn't get selected for the Olympic Games, unlike the two previous Olympics I've been to. So in the Olympic years, you get a lot of races because the UCI wants you to be sharp, and the commissaire panel will have worked together at previous events through the preceding season so that they're used to working with each other and they know each other's style and how to work with each other. So in an Olympic year, if you're on the Olympic Games, road or track or whatever, you'll do more events generally than you normally would. This year I have the two World Tour races here in Australia plus the Road National Championships next week. Then I've got a race in the Tour of Taiwan. Then I've got a track race in Bundaberg. Should be exciting.
Are they all by choice or is that you have to do different levels?
No, the UCI appoints you, and also part of my responsibilities, I work on the UCI Commissaires Commission. So I'm helping train commissaires around the world and ensure that we've got commissaires in different parts of the world so that everyone doesn't have to come from Europe to a race in South America or Australia or wherever.
Wow.
So we've got, the plan is, and we're slowly working on that, to get bigger, broader group of commissaires around the world so that there doesn't have to be, firstly, the expense of sending guys from Belgium to Peru or wherever, you know.
Yep.
So we have some South American commissaires. So that's one of the goals, and I'm sure that will happen because we've got plans in place for that. But so the UCI points commissaires, sometimes it's based on region, but in the, my case for the World Tour races here in Australia, there's two president commissaires. One is from Spain and one's from Belgium. So the three of us will do the three races, the women's race as well. But I won't be the chief. So generally you're not the chief commissaire.
In your own country.
Okay. So it's impartial. And when that report that gets written that I'm talking about, it's not you're writing a report on
your home country.
Scott McGorry's race that, you know, we've been mates for 20 years.
And you feel like it's hard to rip shreds off him if it's necessary or whatever. It's just going to be biased.
It just needs to be...
Yeah. Unbiased.
It needs to be unbiased, but needs to be seen to be unbiased. Like, I would be unbiased anyway.
Yeah.
But, it needs to be seen to be fair.
And even in a way, I don't know about this for you, but I would be happy with that. Because like you said, there's going to be people that you know, and it would be... I'd just naturally be biased without trying to be. It'd be hard to... I would think anyway. I think that would be a nice situation not to do that and come to a race in France where you've got no connections or anything and you can look at it on with fresh eyes.
Yeah, well, that's the system that's used and it works really well. And you asked about the number of races. Last year, so 2019, when I saw you in Spain, I was 4 weeks at the Vuelta, then went to the Worlds in the UK. So I was away from home for 6 weeks. Mm. So, you know, that was a long stretch from Australia. It's a long way to go to be away for 6 weeks, just following bike races. So,
do all you guys hang out at night, all the commissaires, all the comms?
Depends on the situation and the race. Like in the UK, it was early starts and late finishes, so there wasn't much social time afterwards. We had dinner each night and a glass of wine and then into bed because, you know, it was up at 8 o'clock the next morning to do it all again. So the Vuelta was a bit different. We Spanish eat late, so after a stage, you know, so we had some transfers sometimes, but, you know, generally the commissaires try and be social. We usually during a race we communicate on WhatsApp, so there's then often quite often a hangover after that. So yeah. You know, I had Christmas wishes from the Spanish commissaires. Oh, yeah, you know, so that was nice. Yeah.
So it's a good bunch of guys.
Yeah, generally, well, we've all got the same things in mind. You know, we're all in sport in the sport because we love it.
Yep.
None of us are doing it for the money because there isn't. Yeah. You know, there is none really. We're volunteers. So yeah.
Oh, fantastic. All right, well, let's get into some hard questions now for you. What's the hardest part of the job, would you say? Is it that time away from home or is it making those... What is it? What is the hardest part of the job?
I think the hardest part can be is lack of preparation. So if you go to an event, and this is probably more so with track racing, I guess. I'm also a track commissaire. Because there's so many disciplines on track and there's a different... Or different events on track, sorry... There's different regulations for the sprint, the Kieran, the points race, the Madison, and you've got to know all those regulations. Mm. So before each event, I'll read the regulations just to make sure I'm familiar with...
Are they slightly changing over the years?
Yeah, they are too, and that's also anyone who's checking the regulations should make sure they're reading the most current version of that, not a book that was printed 5 years ago, because it'll be different. So you always need to look on the UCI website. Check the current regulations, and I find that makes things a lot easier if you've recently read something, like a day before.
It's fresh in the mind.
The race is there. You think, I know what to do here because this is, I've just read it, you know. So,
okay.
So I think being prepared helps avoid those difficult situations, but then there is difficult situations where you've got to disqualify someone, such as at the World Championships, the... Dutch rider who was
there you go, Sticky Binnen.
Yeah. Well, motor pacing for 2.5 minutes as a panel. You know, we all went into the TV truck after the race, saw that, and it was unanimous that it was couldn't be allowed. So unfortunately, it was, you know, a situation after the race, but the right decision was made.
I completely forgot about that.
So that's a difficult decision. Like, that's the World Championships. It's not the club race at Lancefield, that, you know.
Yeah. And that's the thing too. I remember when we were sitting back in the hotel thinking about that, we're like, it's a difficult position because he's a young guy and potentially in the future coming up, you know, that would have meant a lot to him. And I'm not going to say it would have been better to do it to a senior pro, but in a way it might have been. But in the end of the day, if he starts learning that way, that's also not a positive thing either.
Yeah, but as a rider, you're not a commissaire, but you know if you do that, there's only one thing that's going to happen.
Exactly.
If you get seen, you get disqualified. So.
And also, it's just like if you get away with it, you're always going to do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I've always said this to someone else. If I get dropped and I can finish without it being ridiculous, I just finish every race. And I said to this guy one day, he's like, yeah, it always stuck in my head and I always finish every race now because... You can, you know, and it's a good thing to do. And it's, if you just keep pulling out of races, all of a sudden you just keep doing it. And I think it's a bad habit. So
I mean, it's a same thing. Even just getting dropped, sometimes, like as a commissaire, I know when I was a rider, I used to hate to get dropped. So when I did get dropped, there was no coming back because I was shot.
Yeah.
But you see, so many guys, they're on the back, and then all of that, you can see they just turn the switch off. That's a mental decision. They just drift off the back, and then. 5 kilometres later,
they're back.
They're only 50 metres back because they can still get there. You know, they haven't really fought hard enough in the first place. So.
How is that, actually? I was going to ask you now, what is the best part of the job? What is it like watching the race from that close? Are you able to observe it as a bit of a semi-fan and see some guys there, you're like, wow, this is interesting watching them go over this climb? or you have to be too switched on in the moment that you can't take it in?
No, well, like if the race is 6 or 7 or 8 hours or whatever, there's obviously moments when, you know, the race is just on and there's no team cars and TV motorbikes are probably the two things we have to watch most. But once the riders are racing, you know, there is that chance just to be a fan, if you like, and watch the race. So usually when team cars are involved or dangerous sections of road or things like that. But, you know, it's the best seat in the house. If the peloton's 170 riders, you're at the back of that group. You can't see the action at the front. So sometimes being a motorbike commissaire at the front would be better, but then it pours rain occasionally, as it did in Yorkshire, so that wasn't much fun.
And also there is, I always see the comms going down the hill, and even I spoke to Graham Watson on the podcast earlier, and one of the questions I asked him was about being on the back of those motorbikes, because one, the weather element, and two, just the sheer speed they have and way they get past the riders. And he just said he had to find a driver that he trusted, and he always travelled with that same motorbike on.
And Graham was probably an interesting guy for that job too, because he used to wear shorts and a short sleeve shirt no matter what the weather was, so he would have got very wet a lot of times and very sunburnt a lot of times, but he took some magnificent photos. So
it was great too. You'd see him sometimes in the peloton. Once I got to know him a little bit, he'd look across in the racing and you just see him right there, you're like, g'day Watto. He's like, g'day Mitch, how are you? You know, it was a cool little thing to have. We spoke about the hardest part in that preparation. What is the actual worst part, the bit that you dread doing? Is it that report?
I guess what I find difficult is, say, take for instance this week, I've got the Road Nationals coming up, then Tour Down Under, then Cadell Evans race, back to back to back. Having all of those races in my head, because I'm at work, we're quite busy. So, and I've got a family and a dog. So there's a lot going on. And so that's probably what I find the most difficult, is
fitting it in.
Is fitting it in. And when I'm thinking about tomorrow's race or this week's race, and then someone asks me a question about next week's race or the one after, and to, because the answer may not be the same for the three races. So that's what I find difficult, I think, is
juggling and
having a lot of things on my plate. But I read my father got a book for Christmas about Peter Brock. And there was a quote inside the back cover, and Brocky said, bite off more than you can chew and chew like buggery. And I guess that's what I'm doing. I've bitten off not as more than I can chew, but it's certainly a mouthful, and I'm just going as hard as I can.
It sounds very much like, and I'm not going to say I'm that busy at all, but I think one thing when you're professional, you always, it's a bit of a different scenario, but you're always travelling, you've always got that suitcase ready, a bit similar to you. And I think one thing I might struggle with when I stop riding is not moving for a period. And maybe that's with you, it is a lot to go, but it's something that's exciting for you all the time. You know there's something always around the corner, and maybe you like that style of life, or you must.
Yeah, well, I'm very fortunate. I met my wife at a bike race, and we've been married 40 years now, so and she understands, you know, I've been a rider for a long time, not at your level, but still trained five or 6 days a week and raced 3 days a week, and holidays were at bike races, and you know, that's been our life for a long time. And then I became a commissaire and got busier and busier, so it's evolved. And as a couple, we've become used to me being away for a while. We've got a nice new dog that keeps her happy and company while I'm away, and you know, we try and have a couple of holidays overseas each year, so you know, it's not
just a juggling act, balancing it.
It's like life in general, isn't it? You've got to get things right.
All right, well, tell me, what is your personal highlight? You did touch on some things there, being over there and seeing the riders up at that close. Is that your personal highlight of the job? Has there been a moment that you've really
That is a highlight, is seeing like the Vuelta that we spoke about that we're in last year. Some of those mountaintop finishes were just in crazy places. So you know, seeing riders actually ride up those roads, including guys like yourself who are not climbers, you know, that was tough. So that was impressive. So I was really glad that I saw that. But as a commissaire, you know, I've been to 2 Olympic Games, 2 Paralympic Games. I've been chief for the last 2 Commonwealth Games. So those are sort of highlights for me, I guess, is, you know, being officiating at the highest level. I was the chief commissaire at the London Olympics for the mountain bike event.
Wow.
I was the only commissaire that did both Olympics and Paralympics in London out of all the commissaires. In Rio, I was the chief commissaire for the Paralympics, and I was the judge referee on the track, and I also did the road. So I was the only commissaire that did all of that. So, you know, that
is
was...
Is that quite an uncommon thing for commissaires to go across so many disciplines, or everyone has to be able to do that?
For London, after the London Olympics, that was my last event as a mountain bike commissaire.
Okay.
Following that, we had to specialise.
Yeah.
So there was virtually road or off-road. Road including track, so road and track commissaires.
Thin wheel racing and fat wheel racing.
Pretty much, yeah. So I was, as a rider, more a track rider. And I was, even though I'd done the Olympic Games as a mountain bike commissaire, track was my main interest along with road. So I decided to go the road and track route rather than mountain bike. And then at the next Olympics in Rio, I did the road, the track, and then the Paralympics as well. So that's sort of the highlights for me, I guess, is being in charge of an event at the very highest level. So,
Awesome. That's awesome. What has been the hardest commissaring decision you've had to make over your career?
I remember I didn't realise it was going to be a difficult... It wasn't a difficult decision at the time when I made it, but the result of it was difficult. The World Champion Track Championships, again, track, in Minsk 6 or 8 years ago, I was the judge referee and I disqualified a rider from a sprint in the points race. He'd won the sprint, but he rode illegally to win that sprint, so I disqualified him from that sprint, or relegated him. And at the end of the race, he missed out on being world champion by about 3 points. So, again, like the Dutch rider at the Road Worlds, you know, disqualifying or relegating a rider for something he did and then find out afterwards that it's going to cost him the medal. But it's the right decision to make because he did... So I've tried to look at most decisions as based on merit rather than what the circumstances are, whether it's going to cost a rider a contract or whether his manager's going to be upset with him or he's going to be angry or whatever. You need to look at the circumstance, make your judgment based on what's actually happened.
Yeah, rather than take that all in and then let your emotions take over.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Have you had any mistakes along the way, and what has been the biggest mistake if you've made one?
I'm sure I've made one.
That you can remember. You're like, you know what? I was wrong there.
I try not to dwell too much on the bad things.
Sorry.
I'll say that I don't... I'm sure I've made mistakes, but none that have been bad.
Yeah.
I try and prepare well, and I guess this is why I get a number of appointments, either from Australian or the UCI, is because I do a good job. So I hope that's the case. You might know of some mistakes I've made. Have you?
Well, you should remember. You should have let me hang on to that bottle for a few more K up that last climb in the Vuelta. No, that's okay. That's good. That's a good point. Then you know, if you were like, well, there's so many that spring to mind, I'm just going to have to choose one. That's a horrible thing. And I think you pointed it out. There's a reason why. Yes, I'm sure we all make mistakes along the way, but there's a reason why you're getting appointed all the races that you said, and the caliber of races, because you're not making those big mistakes. Which I'm happy to say, and I've just been watching the cricket, and one thing I'm really not liking at the moment is the DRS, which is the I don't even know what DRS stands for.
Video review, though, whatever the DRS stands for. Yeah.
And I just hate that, because now the umpires there are completely undermined. Every decision they make in that split second, they get put straight up against, you know, like all this technology that can barely find out the decision in the end. So. Mm. I like the fact, the human element, that yes, umpires can be wrong sometimes in cricket and in cycling. Sometimes there is a wrong decision, but sometimes there is a right decision. It's just it's the way the game goes.
Yeah.
And I think that has to stay, the human element.
Well, we're all human, the riders, the team managers, the commissaires as well. And often a team manager or a rider will make a mistake. And sometimes it's bad enough that we have to do something about it. Other times, it's not something that we act on immediately, but perhaps speak to them after the race and say, look, you did this today. I don't want to see that again, or, you know, some advice like that. And I guess as a commissaire too, if you make a mistake, a manager or a rider will certainly come to you and say, that wasn't right. Actually, you ask about mistakes I've made. Perhaps in some races I've made a barrage too soon or too late or not long enough, or I'm sure that sort of thing has happened, because race situations, as you'd be aware, fluctuate sometimes so quickly, and sometimes we think a bunch is going to been dropped, is going to stay away, and we make a barrage.
Just explain a barrage for anyone out there who doesn't know exactly what that is.
if the race splits and there's a likelihood of team cars can be between the front group and the next group and assist the dropped group to come back, we'll actually stop the team cars behind the group until the gap maybe 30 seconds or a minute, let two or three team cars forward to go to the front group. So it's called a barrage, again a French word, but it's a barrier just so that the cars can't get into the gap. So that's probably, in a big road race, one of the main roles of the commissaire is to ensure that the race is ridden by bike riders, not by cars.
Yeah, actually that's probably, I didn't think about that, that's probably one thing that does bug me a lot, because often I'm trying to come back from getting dropped on a climb and I know it's the rule, but I'm trying to get away with it as much as I can, and all your hope is, if we can just get to the car convoy, we're going to make it. And then all of a sudden you're like, geez, that car convoy is coming back quick.
Yeah.
And then you realise it's been barraged. But I understand why it happens. It's only that we're on the limit and we want to get back in the race. Yeah. That we just want any way you can get back, there.
Yeah, for sure. And it's a bit like earlier we're talking about sticky bitten. Sometimes it matters whether that group's barraged or not.
Yep.
You know, if it's a sprinter and we're 30Ks from the finish and the rest of the race is flat, we don't want the sprinter coming back unfairly,
yeah,
and then beating the rest of the guys in the sprint. So barrages, we do look at who's in the group, whether it's actually going to matter or not.
Mm.
But if it's towards the end of the race, you know, if there's still 180 kilometres to go,
and there's been a crash or something, yeah, even.
Again, in the Vuelta, the day there was the big crash, and I think your team lost a couple of riders.
Yeah.
We just let the riders come back behind the car because it was carnage. It was in a sharp corner. The cars couldn't get to the riders. There was guys over the fence, and it was a real mess. So just because it was early in the race, well, like I think stage 4 or 5, early in the stage as well, you know, it was important that the race still had 150 riders, not 60 riders left in the race for the next 2 weeks. So,
yeah,
you know, so we need to take that sort of thing into account and be realistic and be fair.
Can you discuss that between the three comms, or someone, whoever's near the situation, will just make that decision, or is there a continuous conversation going between everyone?
I wouldn't say it's continuous, but in that case, I think that day I was Commissaire 3. In the Vuelta, we rotated positions each day.
Okay.
So Com 1 was always Com 1, but Com 2, 3 and 4, we would rotate each day. And I think that day I was Com 3 because I was behind that crash. So we would talk a little on the radio, but not continuous, because each of us, even though we're numbered 1, 2, 3 and 4, we all have the same qualification and authority to do something, you know. So
you don't need to discuss with so and so about making a decision. No, you just need to make that decision.
If you're uncertain, you would certainly consult the chief and say, this has happened, what do you think?
Yeah.
Because ultimately, it'll be the chief commissaire who has to speak to the race organiser, yeah, or to the team managers at the end of the day and write his report to the ECI.
Who does the flag out the top of the sunroof? At the start of the race?
In some races, it's the Commissaire 2,
who's
the official in front, and by the regulations, that's how it should be, but it's usually the race organiser or someone from the race organisation.
Oh, yeah. Is that a good job to do?
Oh, it's a bit of fun, I guess,
yeah,
because you'd be out the roof and talking to the guys and, you know, and it's not your car, so they're not rubbing the paint off your bumper bar, you know,
yeah,
it's someone else's car. Like, everyone wants to be motor pacing, so... But sometimes it's a bit stressful. I was Com 2 in the Sun Tour 10 years ago maybe, and we're neutralised coming out of this little town, and we had to go at a moderate pace because someone had punctured in the neutral, but all the guys at the front wanted to go hard, and I had riders all around the car and a couple trying to get in front, and it was just almost out of control. So
that bugs me, actually, even as a rider. I think probably one time in my career I was one of those guys, but eventually you're just like, this is... Just respect the commissaire, stay behind the car, and let's get this race started.
Yeah.
There's guys trying to get in front of the car. And
yeah,
for everyone out there who doesn't understand how a road race actually starts, is we roll out from the start village, and there can be a neutral can be anywhere between 1 and, what's the official, 20K.
Yeah,
some are pretty long.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a car in front of us pacing us at a slow speed, and then they drop the flag at kilometre zero and we all race. So that's what I was asking Greg about.
Yeah, so when that approaching kilometre zero, the chief commissaire who's behind the race, he will have noted the riders that have stopped for mechanical reasons, and it's unbelievable how many guys have gear problems and punctures in the neutral.
Like in uphill starts too.
Oh, it's
I'm
just
loving that.
It's crazy. But then, you know, it's only fair that those riders are actually at the start when kilometre zero arrives. So if they've stopped for a nature break, then
they're
on their own. But if a guy's had a mechanical, then sometimes we go past the kilometre zero before we actually pull the flag in.
Yeah. Well, I'll just ask you one last question. What's your favourite race to commissaire? And you did mention a couple out there. And different, two questions. What's your favourite race to commissaire, but what's your favourite race to watch? Is it a different thing, I wonder?
I'm sure it is. I don't watch many races. If I'm at a race, I'm commissaring. Favourite races, I guess, in Australia, probably my favourite race weekend is the Bendigo-Madison weekend.
Wow.
I go up to Bendigo for 3 days and a couple of days of track racing, but the Madison on the Sunday night, you know, I raced that a number of times myself as a rider.
Yep.
And it's, you know, it's a great race and nice atmosphere and a nice town and nice people. So, you know, I find that really enjoyable, Bendigo, that long weekend.
Do you commissaire that?
If I'm in Australia, I've probably done 6 of the last 10 or something like that. But you know, I've been away other times, but I try and, if the UCI point me to an event, I'll go to the UCI race. But if they haven't, then I'll try and do the Bendigo weekend. So as a someone who raced in, like, first raced in Bendigo when I was 15, that's a long time ago. I actually won the race there, the first weekend I raced there when I was 15, so that was a good memory. I raced the Bendigo Madison a few times.
Did you win the Bendigo Madison?
No, I got fourth 1 year. I actually got fourth twice, I think, but yeah. Not better than that. So that's one of my favourite local races. Obviously, doing the World Tour races in Australia is also good. Tour Down Under is a super well-organised race. Great location, being based at the Hilton Hotel. Roll out of there every day.
It's very easy.
Come back.
It's lovely.
For riders, teams and commissaires, it's fantastic. The Cadell Evans race with Shalambra Hill.
Yep.
You know, as a commissaire in the car or a spectator on the side of the road, that hill is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I can't believe Tor Hushov won the world championships around there for a guy as big as him.
I think you're explaining the only people who enjoy that hill. The commissaire in the car and the people on the side of the road. The people in the middle of the road riding up there, they're not liking that at all, I can tell you.
Are you sure?
Yes, I am sure.
So they're probably the local races. Overseas, I've done the Tirreno Adriatico a couple of times in Italy. And that's a really nice race. Again, good organisation, RCS, who do most of the Italian races.
Have you done the Giro?
No, I haven't done the Giro, but I've done a lot of their other races. I did Milan-San Remo, Strada Bianchi. Milan-San Remo, a long day, 300 kilometres at 40k an hour, whatever it was. It's a long day in a car. So I guess there's some of the races, yeah.
Great. Well, Greg, thank you very much for having a chat to me. And next time I see you, we'll probably be on the other side of the fence. But I'm sure we'll get to have a little smile and say hello.
Well, maybe like in the Vuelta, we'll get a photo together.
Yeah. Did you end up getting that photo?
I've got that photo.
Do you?
Yourself and the other mullet from New Zealand and myself. So I'll send that on to you.
Yeah, great. I'll put it up on the website.
So Shane Archbold, Mitch Docker and Greg Griffiths. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks,
good,
Greg.
Good on you, Mitch. Thanks. Yeah.
Well, there we have it. Now you're going to know exactly what's going on in the race coming up in the next month with the Vuelta España, but also for the races in the future. I thought it'd be good to get that little insight from behind the scenes, how all that stuff happens, how they let the sticky bottle hang on or not hang on. I don't know. What did you think, Lionel? Did you get any good little snippets, little insights there from Greg?
I did, yeah. I mean, it's always, there's always a sense that in the peloton when there's, you know, 150 or 180 riders, it tends to be whether you get spotted just bending the rules too far, rather than, you know, the commissaires able to penalise every single infraction. And I guess there is a little bit of that, isn't there? There is a sort of grey area, and then the commissaires are using their discretion as to when they apply the rules strictly and when they don't. I mean, I guess that's something that you get to learn with experience.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think one thing that I really loved about talking to Greg, and I've known Greg for many years, but you sort of build up this barrier between, it's maybe like a teacher and a student. All of a sudden you see your teacher outside of school and they're just a normal person, and that's obvious. But in school, they're the teacher. And that was the same thing with the commissaire. It's like, they're the comms, we're the writers, there's this, oh, these police type feel about it. But sitting back talking to Greg and hearing about what he does with his family and his time away, and it's really a job out of love. He said there's not really much money in it. You're like, hang on, the comms are just normal people. And I know it's a funny comment to make, but I love that he just sort of broke down that barrier, especially for me, and explained it. And it just gave me a little bit more sympathy to them. And like, sometimes you're really getting pissed off in the moment, but actually they're just trying to do the best they can out there. And just like us, they're just doing the best they can, and they're human. So I thought that was quite a nice element.
Over the course of your career, Mitch, have you racked up a few fines here and there? And how does it work when we see the communique at the end of a stage of a Grand Tour and it says who's been fined for what infraction? Often it's the fairly minor things, such as, like you say, a sticky bottle or another one, you know, that obviously has to be penalised because, it kind of brings the race into disrepute, is if riders stop for a pee break in, you know, close proximity to the public. That's another one that often gets fined. But in terms of over the course of your career, have you been a pretty good boy?
I have got a few fines along the way, but you don't actually know you're getting the fines. There's not like someone coming up giving you a red card. And that sometimes does frustrate me because I'm thinking, I don't know, did that actually happen? You know, it could be you threw a bottle in a... this is actually what happened last year in the Vuelta. They put out a pretty strict rule about throwing bottles away. They try to nullify it. And they said, if you throw bottles to fans or people on the side of the road, that's okay. But if you throw bottles just aimlessly into the forest or somewhere, you're going to get a fine. And we just seem to be racking up fines after fines. This is our team. And me, even I haven't got a few. And I'm thinking, I don't know about this. And it was quite frustrating at the time, and it sort of made you think about what you were doing and whether this is, because it was very, very hard to police. If you're in the middle of the bunch and you hoist a bottle out of the peloton, it was very difficult to police. So it is difficult sometimes to receive those fines because there's no moment where you got it and you think, oh, that was from that exact moment there. Obviously, there are cases where I have actually had a bit of an argument with a moto com about barraging us and we're trying to get back, and I received a fine for that, and I knew exactly about that. But those other ones are a bit grey, and you just got to accept it sometimes because that's the way it is, and that's the sport. You know, if you think about any other sport, they're now bringing in the video refs and things like that, which is something I don't necessarily like. I think the human element is part of the sport. You know, if you think of cricket or tennis, it's just getting a little bit too complex for me. So I hope we don't go down that line. I do like that, and I have to accept that sometimes, you know, some decisions aren't exactly correct, or maybe you don't agree, but that's just the name of the game.
Yeah, just on the throwing away of the bottles. I mean, they have introduced the green zones now, haven't they, which give the riders the opportunity to throw bottles and any other waste away where it will be picked up and collected, almost like a rubbish bin along the course. Just explain that term barraging. That's basically using the convoy, the cars in the convoy, as a slipstream to bridge the gap back up to the peloton after you've had either a crash or mechanical. I mean, it's one of those things that we see so often, and there's almost an indefined line, isn't there, between what you can get away with and when you're kind of taking the mickey, really.
Yeah, I think when there's been a crash or a puncher, 9 times out of 10 there's a blind eye turned to someone using the convoy or an individual car to slipstream back to the peloton. That is sort of an unspoken rule, and like I said, 9 times out of 10 that is the way it happens, and they allow you to come back that way. When the barrages happen is normally when the peloton is split on a climb, and we're trying to, when I say we, often me, trying to come back from the back. You know, you're with a small group, you're trying to catch up to the peloton on the descent, and the convoy behind, you know, it could be up to sort of 40 cars behind the peloton. That's quite long. So if you can get to the convoy, essentially you're already in the peloton, but that could mean you're almost like a few hundred meters behind the peloton. So what the commissaires will do is they will just make that whole convoy following the peloton stop on the side of the road. So all of a sudden, you think you're going to get back to the convoy. You know if you can get in the car convoy, you're going to eventually get through the slipstream and get back to the peloton. All of a sudden, you've got another 200 meter gap or whatever it is. It could be even 500 meter gap of cars just move out of the way, and then you've got to close that again. And when you're on the limit and you're trying to come back and it's very crucial at that moment and that car convoy gets moved out of the way, barraged out of the way, it can be so frustrating, but it is the rules, you know. And like I said before, sometimes that doesn't happen and you're lucky enough, you get in that convoy, you get through the slipstream from the cars, maybe grab a few bottles on your way through for your teammates and get back to the peloton and you're back in the race until you hit the next climb, that is. But it is a part of the racing, and it can be quite frustrating when you do get barraged at the pointy end of a race or at the pointy end of a grand tour, that is.
And there's the commissaires in the cars, but there's also commissaires looking out for infringements and just kind of refereeing what's going on, I guess, on motorbikes, isn't there?
That's right. Yeah, they're just floating around between all the groups, because once everything splits up over these climbs or even in the cobbled races over the cobbled sectors, there are certain groups trying to come back, and team cars can get in between those groups and actually help riders to get back. Or that's generally what they're trying to police, is just slipstreaming from team cars. And they're just monitoring that and making sure those groups stay separately, or they're using the right way to get back, you know, just physically riding back yourself. So there's plenty of comms out there, and like I said, I hope that did give you a little bit more of an insight to how the game is policed out there. I do want to say a very big thanks to everyone who got in on the caps, the Talking Luft caps, or the Life in the Peloton cycling casquettes, because they ran out the door again. They've all sold out, unfortunately, but I've been loving the pictures coming in. Everyone is certainly getting themselves around Luft and Talking Luft. Some epic pictures coming in of those caps. I'm loving it. So thanks, guys. Thanks again for listening. And coming up next week, there'll be another Talking Luft. In 2 weeks' time, another podcast. So look out for me on the Vuelta a España. And thanks again for listening. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.